This is continuing the interview with Plato Malazimov on May 5th, 1988.
The Helicopter Exploration Company actually staked the claims and acquired the rights to this prospect. And in 1953, Granby Consolidated Mining, Smelting, and Power Company, then managed by Larry Postal, bought out Carl Springer and incorporated a new company by name of Grand Duke Mines Limited. The Grand Duke was named after the Grand Duke's Glacier that actually came in a valley just below the prospect that was located, and the foot of this glacier was not too far away from the prospect. This the access from the other side, from Portland Canal, was blocked by the Berendon Glacier on the west and by Salmon Glacier on the south. So there was just no way to get to it except by way of crossing these glaciers. And however, from the north, you could get into it in a valley of Unuk River, U-I-N-U-K River, which flowed into the ocean, so that presumably access could be organized that way. But in any case, in order to get to the prospect, you had to get up on a Le Duc glacier, Le Duc, and it was considered. The name of the company was Grand Duke.
Granby and Le Duc.
Le Duc, exactly.
Okay.
After Granby acquired this, our field geologist, Cannon, examined this prospect and recommended it to John Dryburgh, who wrote to Postal about it and wondered whether he would entertain the notion of Newmont acquiring an interest in this. Larry Postal was known to Newmont because he operated for Newmont a small nickel mine that we had in British Columbia called Western Nickel. It was rather small, not worth really describing in detail, but it was originally a prospect. We decided to equip it. We equipped it rather cheaply, and essentially on basis of contracts at very high prices of nickel. That there was a nickel price blip at that time, and we happened to hit the very high prices and made some contracts in Italy and in Austria and Germany. And on the basis of those high contracts, it seemed to be justified to develop it, which we did develop. And then when we began to ship nickel to Europe, by that time the nickel price collapsed, and the European refused to honor the contract and wanted to cancel it. And the Italians actually canceled it, and the Austrians canceled it, but the Germans did not. We made a final deal with the Germans to receive some of the contract at a different price. But anyway, the whole thing was rather unattractive, and we ended up by selling it to a small Canadian company by name of Giant Nickel Company. At any rate, this was our our acquaintance with postal was made at that time. And so we thought that we had good opportunity of perhaps having him agree to Newmont's participation in Granby. Turned out to be difficult in that Postal was a real entrepreneurial type, and he always wanted to run his own company, and he was afraid that a giant like Newmont would displace him, and he was very reluctant to give up, to have Newmont come in. This he never actually expressed, but we surmised, and I think the surmise was correct. It turned out that there was a chairman of Granby was at that time Julian Beatty, who was a lawyer, quite an elderly man in his 70s, knew some of the Newmont people and knew of me also. And originally he was a lawyer and general counsel for Phelps Dodge, and actually counsel even for Metallgesellschaft, so that he was acquainted with the mining community and knew something about mining, although not being a mining company. He was also with the American Metal Company and Climax Molybdenum, as served as a lawyer for them. At any rate, when Beatty heard of our interests, he prevailed on Postal to give us a sympathetic hearing. And this resulted from a discussion that I had with Julian Beatty. At one point, one of our points of contact was that his son, who lived in Greenwich, was a doctor, and he happened to be our family doctor, so this was a good good point. But he knew of me also, and it was a very friendly relationship that I had with him.
Excuse me, would you mind spelling Beatty?
B-E-A-T-Y.
One T.
B-E-A-T-Y. Well, that led to a deal finding, and Granby eventually sold their entire interest in Newmont. Fred Searles at that time was not in favor of this, actually, so I had that much opposition on the board, but the rest of the board supported me, and we made the deal and started the exploration. And the exploration was a difficult venture because to supply the kind of an effort that we put into it, and it was partly underground mining as well as drilling. I mean, the underground development as well as drilling. We no longer could depend on helicopters, and actually had to use a fixed-wing plane, and we devised airstrip right on top of the glacier. The only trouble with that was that when summertime came, why the strip which we covered with some gravel in order to give some stability to the surface, because of the insulating effect of the gravel, stood up like a ridge.
Oh.
As the glacier partially melted down, so we had to do it all over again. Anyway, it was an arduous, expensive experience, but it worked. We never wrecked the plane.
You were working year-round then at the mine?
Yes. Mm. Well, especially in the wintertime, because it was easier to work in the winter times there. Anyway, the exploration continued for quite some time, and one time we were, while exploration was going, we were concerned about, well, what would, if we really found something that was worth developing, what would be the access route? And we knew the access route from Portland Canal had this glaciers and the problem to that. So overland route would be a difficult one, except over the glaciers, which was not an attractive possibility. So we decided to investigate the river from the ocean up the Yunuk River. And Banghart and I decided to make a very preliminary survey of this just from the helicopter, and then go to the exploration site to look at what they were doing in exploration. Well, their arrangement was that we would catch a small chartered plane from Ketchikan and come to the mouth of the Yunuk River, which was uninhabited. There's no camp there, no nothing. And a helicopter that we were using at that time would pick us up there and take us to the mine. Well, we landed at the mouth of Yunuk River with fixed wing plane, which was a hydroplane on the river, and they let us off and promptly took off, and off they went. There was no helicopter in sight, so we thought, well, we're probably a little early, although we were just on time, and we were supposed to have there. Anyway, we waited and waited, and no helicopter, and there was nothing there. I mean, we couldn't possibly get anywhere. There was no settlement, no nothing. Certainly, we couldn't swim. We didn't have a radio. We couldn't advise anybody if something happened to the helicopter. It was a terrible risk to take. And then on top of it all, we recognized bear tracks right close to us, and we said, oh my God, if we have to spend the night, are we going to be able to spend it? We had a small case, each case for only an overnight case, and both of them were identical. Actually, we bought it at the same time, small little things like this made out of cardboard. And Banghart got a little tired. He's older than I, but big man. He probably weighed about 210 pounds or something like that. Anyway, he sat on this fork suitcase and it collapsed. So we had a laugh over that. But it became rather anxious, you know. And anyway, we waited probably for about 2.5 hours, and finally the helicopter came and took us out.
It was a long
2.5 hours. Oh. Well, during the time that we were exploring this and trying to evaluate it, doing the drilling and underground work, we were able to observe the general climatic conditions, and we found to our surprise that the snowfall in this area was 110 feet a season. So we had to confront ourselves with very difficult situations there, and the end of the exploration, at the end of the exploration, we did find some ore. I think it was something like 40 million tons, and 32.5 million tons at it was even less than that, something on the order of 20 million tons of pretty good ore, but not really enough to justify an expensive venture. So we thought that perhaps we might be missing something in drilling in this one place, and we asked Dr. Hal Norman, who was then on our staff, exploration staff in Canada, and was an eminent geologist working for the Canadian Geological Survey for many years, and well known for his pioneering work in certain types of deposits. Excellent geologist. Asked him to come over and see if he could find something that we weren't aware of that might enlarge the reserve possibilities. Well, he spent some time, and in the meantime, we suspended our exploration, took the people out. Well, he spent the summer down there, and actually had some people with a crew and with a diamond drill. And what interested him was an outcrop across the glacier, across the valley, right across where we were doing drilling, where it appeared that there was an outcrop. Nobody had been there before, but at any rate, he went over and took some samples right on the surface of the cliff and decided to drill, and indeed found a quite high-grade ore of considerable width, a possibility of an ore body there. The amount of drilling that he did was minor. I think he only drilled about four or five holes, and six holes, and I think of those six, four struck ore, and very good ore. And looking at the geology and surmising what the tectonics was, he felt that there was quite a possibility that actually the ore body extended in depth under the glacier, and what we saw on the other side was part of the same ore body, which was in effect eroded by the glacier in the valley between these two outcrops. Well, that gave additional promise to look for the ore in depth, and we resumed exploration after that examination and incidental drilling that he did. And indeed, we found more ore. By 1963, the reserves were calculated to be 32.5 million tons of 1.3% copper. By this time, we'd spent $6 million. With this, we thought we had enough to mount a venture. We proceeded to try to evaluate it in a preliminary sort of way in-house, and one of them, the person that was given this responsibility was John Wise, who was the chief engineer at Iditarod Mining Company, and we brought him back to be a staff engineer in Newmont. He came up with a figure of $55 million, which we proceeded to see how we could finance it. And at that time, Hecla heard about this, Hecla Mining Company heard about this, and they wanted desperately to try to enlarge their exposure to various deposits, and here was something that was bigger than their own, and they wanted to diversify into copper. And they begged to have an interest in this. I remember very distinctly that at the time I counseled them against this, I said that this was a very risky venture. We don't know whether it's going to succeed or not, and if you were to join the financing, there is a possibility you might lose everything. And Les Randall, who was running Hecla at that time, said, yes, we're prepared to take the risk, but I still want that because we really want to diversify into something. So I've offered to have them have a preferred stock, which is a little better than we did, so that they'd have a preferred position in the whole thing, for $10 million. I went to Asarco, and they were willing to advance $10 million for this financing against the concentrates that we would send to them for smelting. And then I went to Bankers Trust and arranged a $30 million loan. That needed $50 million. And Newmont had, by that time, spent, as I said, $6 million. And we were willing to put up additional $5 million as working capital, so it would be a total of $55 million. Well, The next step was to put it in the hands of contractors and make a final feasibility report and a re-estimate of the whole thing. And I called upon our friends in Bechtel, and they had various schemes of access that they thought about. One of the schemes was a very long tunnel to get under all these glaciers and get in from Grand Duke, but I thought it was impractical because the tunnel was going to be something like 25 miles long, 30 miles long. So we decided that wasn't the thing to do, but finally we ended up by deciding that proper access would be from the Portland canal side, but at about the level of the foot of the Barrendon Great Glacier, which would give us an access of 10.5 mile tunnel to the prospect. The next thing was that the final estimate turned out to be not $55 million, but something like $88 million or $85 million. By this time, I became rather apprehensive about the whole venture, but still felt it was worthwhile going ahead. But considering the risky nature of it, I thought that we had better finance it in some different way and not involve ourselves with bank financing at all. So we canceled the Bankers Trust debt, and I proceeded to try to see what we could do in a different kind of a deal. And the new deal that I conceived and finally sold was with ASARCO, that ASARCO and Newmont would go in as 50-50 owner, but not as owners of the property, but as owners of a lease. And this has a significance in that a completely different tax allocation would come to this. And we actually surrendered our shares to the Grand Duke Company, which had the preferred stock that Hecla owned, in return for a royalty. But the royalty was not off the top, but the royalty off profits, provided we made the profits. And we had a very difficult negotiation. On the other side, negotiation was Les Randall. And finally, in order to make some kind of a deal, we consented to 22.5% of the profits to Grand Duke as their royalty. However, we so structured that we would get that only if we got our capital expenditure back first. So it wasn't too bad a deal. By cancellation of Newmont shares, Hecla went from 16 2/3% to 34.5% of Grand Duke. And the lease structure allowed ASARCO and Newmont to write off all the development and exploration expenses against other profits that we received with other ventures. Mm-hmm. So in effect, what we were doing was using 50-cent dollars instead of one 50-cent dollars in doing this exploration. So it cost us that much less for the total development. So that in effect, in funding the $88 million, we already had $10 million from Hecla, so we had $78 million to divide between us, which is $39 million apiece, but because of the tax function, it amounted to $17.5 million apiece.
So you were the owners of the lease. You leased it from Grand Duke Corporation.
Mines, which we owned. Beaver, but by just contributing our shares to Grand Duke, which was a surviving company. Mm-hmm. Well, this rather involved deal was actually conceived by one of our lawyers, Frank Reinhardt, and we saw the merits, both Jack Thompson and I, and mm-hmm. we structured the whole deal that way. That permitted us to go ahead, and it was decided to the tunnel that I speak of, 10.5 million ton long, was decided on, and we decided to try to complete it as fast as possible by driving it from both ends, from the port of canal end. One crew would do this, and the other one would drive the same tunnel from the mine end. So we established a fairly large camp. Maybe, I think there was something like 60 or 70 people involved in further development of the ore body and driving of the tunnel. The first year that we started doing this, winter came on, and we decided to continue operations during the winter time, which we did. And next spring, a tragedy occurred in that an avalanche let loose enormous amount of snow that went right into our camp, the exploration camp, killed 26 people, injured 19 more. Mm-hmm. And of course, everything stopped as a result of that. We were exonerated from being culpable in this accident, in that we could prove and show to them that prior to this avalanche, the avalanche paths that are clearly marked by the fact that where avalanche occurs, all the trees and scrub trees would be wiped out, were marked in our camp was away from that. So this was absolutely something new that hadn't happened before, and in the life of the glacier, or at least in the life of the trees and so on. So you couldn't very well accuse us of not considering this. At any rate, it was a very, very traumatic experience, and of course a lot of publicity resulted from this, and we had to keep our announcements of this in a proper fashion, not to create the proper reaction by the press and by the public in general and so on. And I must say, we did a pretty good job without having a professional public relations firm. We did masterminded this all ourselves. However, we interrupted all exploration, all activity, and decided to reassess the whole thing. And then the reassessment began, first of all, with, well, what are we going to do with the tunnel? Obviously, we're not going to subject any more people on that side of the mountain, because of this was an erratic avalanche. We could have another erratic avalanche wherever we made a camp. So we'd have to drive this tunnel only from one end. So that required a completely new sort of engineering approach and how we were going to do it and how long it would take and so forth. After an interruption of some I think about a year and a half or two, they decided to continue with this, again with some apprehension about this. I must say that we kept on reassessing this venture, and in those days, back in the 1960s, the cost of labor when we started was relatively low. We paid only $5 an hour for labor, and seemed to be quite stable. The inflation wasn't too bad at that time. Furthermore, before even we started this, we made a contract with the Japanese to receive our concentrates, smelt and refine it, and they offered us excellent terms, which I think amounted to something like 7 or 8 cents a pound for smelting and refining, and transportation at that time also was very low, so that I think the whole transportation and smelting and refining was something on the order of 10 or 11 cents a pound. So the economics still looked pretty good on this, and we did allow for some inflation, but moderate inflation. Actually, however, by the time we started, inflation was much higher than we thought. But before we do that, I may mention that some of the things that were done in driving that tunnel were achieved world recognition. For example, we made a world record in the speed of advancing the tunnel for 1 mile in 73 days. And occasionally we hit an advance of 93 feet in one single day. It was highly mechanized, beautifully done with the most modern equipment that we could find, and so on. So the driving of the tunnel was a remarkable success that was, you know, people wondered about all over the world.
Were there any other fatalities other than the avalanche accident?
Any other
fatalities?
No.
Your tunnel had no fatalities.
However, that avalanche activity, of course, called our attention
the avalanche activity caused you to
a complete reexamination of the snow danger, not only at that site, but also of the snow danger and the access route. In order to arrive at the place where we started the tunnel, we had to make a 31.5-mile road, right along the Salmon River and later Salmon Glacier. And that road took us past a lake, very deep, long, narrow lake called Tide Lake, which was about 5 miles long. And the part of the road that went up the Salmon River on the side of the on which we were of this river, the mountains rose quite high and there was very high snowfall there, and we hired a special expert on snow removal and avalanches by name of Monty Atwater, who acquired his expertise in Switzerland, later in Chile, and of whom Bob Koenig knew because he actually used them. So he recommended him when he heard about this, that we hired this man, and he did, and he made a survey of the whole thing, identified the danger spots, and recommended remedies, and the remedy was to put up 75-millimeter guns that you'd shoot down the snow before it became dangerous, and then you would clear up the snow, all this mountain of snow that came down on a road, clear it up by bulldozers. And that way you never had the killer avalanches. And there were, I think, 3 or 4 avalanche sites like that that were located by him, and we located the artillery and every winter we would shoot these down.
What about your insurance in a case like this?
Well, the installation of the mill and the power plant that we had to build right at the mine were not in danger of this. We could not get any insurance on the road because of this avalanche danger. Well, our actual experience was that while we were
kept the avalanches under control, yet the cost of removing the snow in certain parts was so high that we had to actually tunnel into the rock to avoid these areas. Mm. So that road cost us about twice as much as we expected it to cost. It was very difficult of access. However, we did all of this, and it was really technically brilliantly conceived and brilliantly executed venture. Production began in 1970 and continued until we finally shut it down because we could not make any money on it. Actually, one of the additional problems was the mining method. And this we anticipated as being a real problem. And even before we started the tunnel, we had decided to find experts that would give us some guidance as to what the economics of mining would be. And we had Hunt, who looked at this, and had in the meantime had made several trips to Sweden, recommended we use Swedish engineers who devised a new method called sublevel caving, which was not used in this country, was used in Sweden and began to be used in Mount Isa in Australia. And we actually sent people to look at how they were doing in Mount Isa and Sweden and so on before we adopted the method. One of the critical things about this method was the recognition that there would be dilution from the waste rock, because we were dealing with rather wide veins, but still, when you cave it, you didn't have any control over what would happen with this, with a country rock on the sides of the on the vein, and that's why we needed expert opinion as to what kind of dilution we could expect to have. Well, the Swedish engineers spent quite some time at our mine, which was then being developed, and came up with very precise numbers, which always bothered me. They said that your dilution would not exceed 16.7%. That's too close a figure. Well, Swedes are entitled tend to do these things. They want to translate everything into very close mathematical figures. And this was not necessarily the kind of figure that they experienced in their own mind. I think their own mind it was something like 13% dilution, but they considered this would have greater dilution. Well, actually, when we mined it, our dilution started out by being about 40% and could never be reduced to less than 35%. And this is one of the basic problems, because all of a sudden we find our grade diluted to that extent. Our facilities that were designed for 16.7% dilution turned out to be inadequate to handle the ore with a 35% dilution. So our production was less, grade was less, costs were as a result higher. And on top of everything, the inflation all of a sudden took a quantum leap just about that time in the late 60s and the early 70s. Mm-hmm. And we found our hourly wages that we thought would probably be somewhere around $7.50 or $9 to be $15, $18 an hour. And the additional problem was, of course, that we found that the productivity of men was lower, therefore we had to increase the capacity. We needed more men. With more men, we needed more housing. Our experience in maintaining a crew there was absolutely dismal. We had up to 35% turnover in 1 month. And the only way that the managers saw to reduce that was to provide family housing rather than have single men, because single men would come and go. And with family men, at least we'd have a more stable crew, and that required more housing, more capital. So everything turned against us, in effect. The inflation,
the cost of labor. The
price of copper was not very good. At any rate, we couldn't make money at it. Finally, we threw in the sponge. And I think it was about 1980. And decided to liquidate the whole thing. And when this was announced, we got an approach from Exxon, or Imperial Oil Company, which is this wholly owned subsidiary, not wholly owned, but majority owned subsidiary of Exxon in Canada, that they might be interested in this mine. And their interest was aroused by a young mining man, whom we knew actually, who had never been involved in a large enterprise, but mined small enterprise, not very much experience. And he convinced the oil company that Newmont did everything wrong and that he knew exactly how to do this in the right way. The mining method was wrong and he could do it much cheaper. This was going to be a good venture, and just Newmont blew it. However, the oil company would not allow him to bid very much for it, and we sold the mine for $8 million. The interesting part of that negotiation, which lasted a long time before the final papers were signed, this was during the winter, and we were in the course of dismantling the thing and selling for scrap the copper wire that we had for the electric haulage that we had, and other parts of equipment and so forth. And we were in the process of doing it when we were start making negotiations and doing the negotiation, and we told the people in negotiating, well, they want us to stop, since you're going to, looks like you want to do this, and you'll have to, you know, replace everything that we're doing. Oh, no, you go ahead with whatever you're doing, we'll replace it. Typical attitude of a prosperous company. What, you know, this is all pennies. I mean, putting in another $20 or $30 million doesn't mean much to us. The final event that was really stupid on the part of the prospective buyers was the approach of winter. We knew of it because of this enormous snowfall, and we had always prepared for it, and we always, for example, the power plant and the mill, we always cleared the roof of any accumulation of snow, so it's excess weight of snow, which was uneconomical to try to build a roof to support that kind of weight. We cleared the snow during the winter time, and this winter was approaching. We were still doing the stripping of the mine and the mill at the time, and we again called this attention to this, and I said, well, do you want us to clear the snow from these roofs, because otherwise these roofs may collapse and there's untold damage. And so, oh, no, don't do it. We don't want to have you do anything on our account that we have to pay you for. They refused to do this, and sure enough, the roofs collapsed.
Oh, my.
Destroyed much of the equipment in the mill, crippled the power plant, and they had to replace all of that.
Oh,
Anyway, I don't know the exact figures, but I think that in addition to paying $8 million for the mine, they spent something like $110 or $120 million for refurbishing the mine again. It was not profitable in the way they were running it, and they had to soak up losses of something, another 100 or 120 million. It cost them about 250 million.
Oh.
And it shut down now.
Oh, well,
complete tragedy.
That is very sad. Plus a lot of lives.
But because of the deal that we made, this lease deal, our exposure, as I said, of actual money that we put in originally was $17.5 million plus the additional money that we had to put for the tunnels and the additional costs that we incurred in controlling snow and so on. I don't know what the exact figures were, but by the time we wrote it off, and again, when you write it off, why, you have a tax credit against that. Our total loss was something under $20 million. And we also, because we were owners at that time when the collapse of the roof occurred, we had a good insurance claim, and finally that lasted. There was a lawsuit on the insurance claim for some time, and finally six or seven years after the event, we got money out of the insurance companies to reduce our losses.
Oh. How did you handle things like these suits? Did you have your own staff counsel, or did you?
Yeah, well, we do. We had a very strong legal department, always did, which I kept up to the strength necessary to handle all these things. And when we had a very special events such as this, we did hire outside lawyers, and actually these insurance suits were handled by outside lawyers.
And these would be in Canada also, so you'd need Canadian lawyers?
I think we insured them with American companies.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever have an organizational chart to keep track of all of these things?
I had, a chart of organization, but I didn't believe in one, because the tendency of having organization charts is as soon as somebody left, you had to absolutely replace them. My theory of management was that you fitted people to what they liked best, and I would actually. It was impossible to make an organization chart in the way I use people. For example, our chief mechanical engineer turned out to be a very thoughtful man that could make analysis and make research on marketing of certain metals, for example. Nothing to do with mechanical engineers, and he did that, which normally would be handled by economics department. I never had an economics department, because I could always find people that were sufficiently interested and smart enough to make that kind of evaluation. So that's one of the reasons I didn't believe in organization charts, because most of my people I utilized in more than two or three specialties. And they crossed lines all over. They would do this sometimes and do something else, and they had different bosses from time to time. It wasn't a very rigid organization.
But
and it was on the part of of the employees that we had, they liked that, because all of them sooner or later would have a very responsible job that they, they were perfectly responsible for, rather than going up the line and having only one thing to do at the time. Also, they had a very variable task to accomplish, and the monotony of doing everything else was avoided by this time. So I always had the reaction by all my employees, and I don't think it was just flattering me, that this was an unusual organization, but they liked it very much, and it was better than any other that they had any experience with. And this I had, and I'm sure this was true, from people that worked all their lives in Kennecott or worked somewhere else and came to us and said, boy, this is like breathing fresh air to be able to do this, because the job is much more interesting than we ever had before. Wayne Burt used to tell me this, who spent all his time in Kennecott, and in Chile, and then in Utah. So, and he's not the only one who said this. When Peter Crescenzo, our chief engineer who replaced Tucker, came, he said the same thing, and many of the others came from the other company, always came to the same conclusion. So I had the marvelous organization with very high morale. And we had more of a team spirit. Anytime we had a big project, I could always organize among them a whole team of people, and they'd work together to allocate among themselves the jobs who'd do best. And they knew that, you know, another job came up, somebody else who was left out of this team, they might come in, they'd always have something interesting to do. So the job themselves, I mean, the compensation was important to them, of course, and I tried to keep our compensation to be competitive, although not of the highest. As a matter of fact, I was always accused of being a Scrooge in that event, but actually when we compared it, our salary level was not low. It was in the sort of a median range, sometimes reached the low. But the thing that commanded loyalty of our organization, and I must say that through the 40 years that I had experience in Newmont, we had very few resignations. I can count them on the fingers of one hand. Mm. All the rest were strictly loyal. I think I fired more people than quit, people quit on me. They were all very loyal and continued right through. I was loyal to them too, of course.
Somebody told me once that you had a heliocentric organization.
Well, I don't know about that.
It must have been enormously complicated to keep with all this multiplicity of companies, though.
Yes, it was. And I tried to keep the organization small. And I know that when we were partners with Rio Tinto, for example, and Palabora, they marveled how it is that at that time we actually were even larger than they were, and on several continents. And we had more ventures than they had. And we did it all with a headquarters organization of about 90 people. And they were doing what they were doing with 250 or 300 people. And they actually sent people to our office to find out how is it that we could do more than they were doing with such a small organization.
Was the reasoning behind establishing all these separate companies for what reason? Taxes, efficiency?
Essentially, tax reasons, and also for ultimately liability. Every time you organize a new corporation, the parent company was not responsible for it. So if anything happened, or any disaster suit, such as we had in Grand Duke, for example, would take place, why, that subsidiary had to handle it and could only risk its own assets and not the parent company assets. This was conceived long before I came to Newmont by Judge Ayer, and he was a lawyer, yeah. And Roy Bonebrake, who succeeded him as a chief as a general chief counsel, was convinced that this was the thing to do. And furthermore, also we insulated ourselves from the imposition of onerous state laws against the company that is actually operating in some other states. So, for example, if we operate in Canada, in Arizona, we try to isolate it from the United States laws. It was actually a Maine corporation. Maine had good laws in terms of corporate activity. And we had Nevada corporations, we had California corporations, so on for that reason.
Well, did you have written policies that were overall the same for all of these?
No, but I think
did
that...
Did you ever have a policy manual? Or?
No. No, but I think that the general policy of behavior, honest behavior, first of all, never giving bribes to anybody else, so was so well understood by everybody that I know of no infractions to that at all. And the general attitudes that we developed of looking after the employees and benefits and going beyond actually the actual benefits of somebody who was in distress, we tried to help this person even beyond the plans that we had by special allocation of funds or help or whatever. This was endemic within the company and accepted as being part of the policy. So
your
I think it was.
Managers had that kind of leeway?
Yes. They understood that they had that kind of leeway. And the morale as a result, I think, even among the subsidiaries was quite high too because of this. And furthermore, I made it a point and all of the principal executives in Newmont adopted this as a method of visiting all the operations at least once a year, and those in charge of the operations would visit them even more often. I made yearly visits to South Africa, as burdensome as that was, in order to visit every operation. This was a kind of a morale builder, and it gave the opportunity my expressing the philosophy of management and the parent company that we wanted to continue among the subsidiary companies. And I think this is part of the reason that we had sort of a unified management, not only in the headquarters, but also in the subsidiaries, with which we had very good contact.
Well, you essentially were still running every one of them.
Oh, yes. Well, no. We delegated, we're very well decentralized, and this was one of the principles, that the managers had great autonomy of action locally, and only when it came to a new project was the authority lodged in the parent company, whether we would do it or not, because we were the ones who would furnish the money for the project or expansion or something like that. But insofar as any local improvements were concerned, provided they had full autonomy to do this. And of course, the frequent visits by the people that were in charge of all operations were designed to know exactly what they were doing, and so that if our chief operating officer in New York found that somebody in Canada was proposing something that was not sound, then he would interfere with it. He would argue with him, try to make it not an order. Now, forget this, you do this. But try to convince him that isn't the thing to do. And it was more by persuasion rather than by an order. This was the style within the whole company. And also we maintained for that very purpose absolutely first-class exploration, independent exploration organization, which could be called upon for any specific geological problem that any subsidiaries have. And we had a metallurgical center for that reason, and I wrote up this kind of thing. This I felt was absolutely important because the technological advancement in this could not be followed as closely by the operating subsidiaries as they could be in a special organization for this. So that they were always available to be called upon, and if not called upon, we made visits actually to see whether there was any metallurgical problems, and if they were, discussed with them, brought it back to the laboratory and masterminded here, and then proposed it them, but always not with the idea of imposing it on them, but saying, well, this isn't the kind of thing that you want to do. So we preserved the semblance of autonomy by the local management. And they appreciated that. And this is, I think, the reason that we attracted some of the better managers, because when managers have to follow the instructions from a centralized authority, why, they don't like it. And this was a great contrast, for example, in the way all South African or English companies were run. In South Africa as well as in England, where they usually had a sort of a supreme consulting engineer, and he would be responsible for anything that anybody did in the operations level, and nobody dared do anything new without having this man approve it. And he wouldn't visit all that often, and sometimes things would go on for months, sometimes years, without making a change because the consulting engineer I didn't want to, or didn't get around to thinking about it, didn't have time for it, or wasn't particularly sympathetic. And usually, you know, these people were not all that great themselves. They were supposed to be qualified people, and they were generally qualified, but not necessarily the universal geniuses that would require to, you know, to be sensitive to the operations, every phase of the operations, in a number of various centers. So in a sense, I think the management style that that pervaded Newmont arose historically from Newmont, because by and large this is the way Newmont ran it, because they had a very small organization here originally, just a few engineers, and they never believed in staff here. I was the first staff engineer that they hired, actually, whereas most of the other companies, like Anaconda, Kennecott, Phelps Dodge, and many of the foreign companies, had huge staffs, geological staffs, mechanical engineering staffs, metallurgical staffs, with various layers of management in the headquarters that had this responsibility and gave comparatively little responsibility to the operations. And I observed that was a good way to run the company, and I continued that general style with the change, with the difference, however, that Fred Searles, for example, was not very consistent about his managing the companies. He very often would go to a property, and because he was the chief executive, say, well, we want to do this, and you guys do this. And the man who was in charge, in nominal charge of operations, DeWitt Smith, would learn about it after it was done. So it created a lot of friction and problems.
Yes. That's not a very good way to do it.
Well, I think that this completes the specific accounts of the operations with which I was connected during my presidency and also during my period of being the chief executive officer as chairman. What remains to be said is, what is the meaning of all of this, and what generalizations one can draw from it? We just touched on the management style, which I think when I read it over, I probably will want to edit it quite extensively. But there are other generalizations that are worth mentioning, which I have thought about and have an outline of, and I will write up.
Oh, all right. Okay. Yeah, we've just about come to the end of the tape.